Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 24, The Second Macedonian War. Last time, we ended with the Roman victory over Carthage in 202 BC, leaving Rome as the undisputed master of the Western Mediterranean. After nearly 20 years locked in a massively destructive conflict, one might assume that the Romans would take some time off. After all, the demise of Carthage left no real challenge to the Roman hegemony in the West, and there was an abundance of new trading opportunities, lands to settle, farms to rebuild, and families to grow. Why not enjoy the fruits of their newfound dominance and retire peacefully to country estates to grow olives and sip wine? Beat the swords into plowshares, as it were, and leave the battlefield unstained with Roman blood. At least for a little while, a generation, maybe? Not likely. Immediately after winning the West, the Romans wasted no time leveraging their newfound big boy status and embroiling themselves in the cutthroat world of Greek power politics. The rationale behind an intervention in the East is obscure, and at first blush doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. The Romans had no long-standing ties in Greece and no true investment in the region. As I've mentioned a few times, the Adriatic divided the Mediterranean into two worlds. The Romans had finally won control of their half. It seemed strange that they would risk what they had just achieved by suddenly launching themselves into the middle of a game they'd never before competed in or stood any real chance of winning without immense effort. But history is what it is, and rather than taking a breath, the Romans moved east as a first step towards capturing the whole of the Mediterranean, a feat never before accomplished, and since the fall of Rome, a feat never again repeated. Roman intervention in Greece was precipitated by a fateful pact between two men who would command the armies opposite the legions in the coming decades, Philip V of Macedon and Antiochus the Great of the Seleucid Empire. The eastern Mediterranean was still very much living in a post-Alexandrian world, and the dominant kingdoms jockeying for position had grown from the satrapies established by Alexander's generals. Egypt was ruled by the descendants of Ptolemy, Syria and Persia were ruled by the descendants of Seleucus, and Macedon, the birthplace of the great general, was re-rising to a position of power under Philip V after years caught up in dynastic struggles. In 204 BC, as Scipio was launching his expedition against Carthage, Ptolemy IV of Egypt died, leaving his six-year-old son as heir. Seizing quickly on the leadership vacuum in Egypt, Philip and Antiochus agreed to jointly exploit the situation and move against Egyptian holdings in Asia Minor and Syria. The idea was simple: attack quickly on two fronts and conquer what territory they could. Around the same time Scipio was dictating terms to the Carthaginians, Antiochus moved south towards the Red Sea, and Philip moved east, attacking Thrace, the territory west of the narrow sea lane that links the Aegean and Black Seas, called the Hellespont in ancient times, and today called the Dardanelles. This joint action immediately upset the apple cart of Greek power sharing and sent the kingdom of Pergamum, which lay on the east side of the Hellespont, into a tizzy. Attalus I, king of Pergamum, smelled absolutely nothing good coming from an alliance between Philip and Antiochus. Attalus's kingdom in Asia Minor bordered both rival powers. It was not hard to divine where the two allied kings would look next when they were done stripping young Ptolemy of his inheritance. But luckily, Attalus had built up invaluable goodwill from the ascendant Romans, who were just coming off their big win over Carthage. Attalus had been amongst those allied with Rome against Macedon during the First Macedonian War. Along with the Aetolians, Attalus had helped keep Philip's attention firmly in Greece, and the Romans understood the role this played in their ultimate victory over Carthage. Or at least Attalus hoped they understood, because it was time for them to repay the favor. Pergamum, allied with the island kingdom of Rhodes, was for the time being holding its own against Macedonian encroachment. But in 201 BC, official envoys were sent to Rome to plead for aid. The Roman Senate, while not forgetting their friendship with Attalus, still sent the Greek envoys away without the promise of aid. They had just come off a costly war with Carthage. Now was not the time to go plunging headlong into Greece. But elements within the Senate argued for immediate action. Philip had been moving for years against Rome, and if his ambition was allowed to proceed unchecked, when his attention inevitably turned back to the West, he would come knocking that much richer and that much stronger. If Rome was worried about the cost of a war today, think of what the cost would be tomorrow. It was agreed then that envoys should be sent to Greece to take the temperature of the locals and reassess whether the Romans needed to take a stand now or whether they could afford to wait. On the road to Athens, the Roman envoys were fast concluding that a war with Macedon was the last thing anyone wanted. But, coinciding with their arrival in Athens, the Athenians declared war against Macedon, and Philip ordered a force to pacify Attica. Meeting with Attalus and ambassadors from Rhodes and Athens, the Romans decided to issue an ultimatum to Macedon: clear out of Greece and come to terms with Pergamum and Rhodes, or deal with the consequences. The Macedonian force in Attica retreated, and the message was taken to Philip. The Macedonian king rejected the ultimatum, ordering his forces to attack Athens again, and moved himself back east to the Hellespont, where he launched a campaign to wrest control of the eastern bank from Pergamum. In 200 BC, Roman envoys found Philip still directing his troops along Pergamum's border and issued him a second ultimatum: withdraw from all Greek cities and confine himself back to traditional Macedonian territory, or he would be looking at war with Rome. Philip protested that nothing he had done was in violation of the treaty he had signed with the Romans at the end of the First Macedonian War, and they were reaching well beyond their authority if they thought they could dictate policy so far from Italy. The second ultimatum, however, was a mere formality. At the same time Roman envoys were explaining what they would do if Philip rejected peace, they were already launching an army, knowing Philip would never accept Roman terms. Confident after securing allies in Greece, the Senate had changed its tune and decided that war now was preferable to war later. Philip had to be stopped before he acquired more strength. Legions under the command of Publius Galba were sent across the Adriatic into Illyria, the Roman beachhead in the east. What followed was a year of indeterminate skirmishing, with neither side doing much to risk their armies. Philip was still trying to get a handle on whether the Romans were truly committed to a war, and Galba had no real interest in a full-on attack. The next year saw changing consuls, but the continuation of the same policy. Open war was not being courted, and the entire affair seemed destined for countermaneuvers until the two sides made concessions to one another and reached an amenable peace. However, in the third year, 198 BC, things would change. Titus Flaminius was elected consul and given command of Greek operations. He fully embraced the notion that Philip had to be brought low, or Macedon would forever pose a threat to Rome. Beyond these immediate strategic interests, Flaminius himself was a great lover of Greek culture, and saw Roman exposure to and power over Greece to be inherently beneficial and well worth fighting for. Flaminius took a bold stand against Philip, and, hoping to win over the mostly neutral Greek cities, recast Roman policy as a defense of Greek liberty. In this conception, Rome was not another power looking for new territory, but a shield against Macedonian tyranny. This recasting of the struggle won over the elites of the Greek city-states, and momentum began to shift towards Rome. His diplomatic coup well underway, Flaminius matched word with action and went looking for Philip's army, intent on breaking the Macedonians. Later in the year, a short battle was fought between the two armies, with the upshot being the withdrawal of Philip and the stage being set for a larger, decisive confrontation the next year. The Greeks were flocking to Rome and away from Macedon. Sensing that the ballgame had changed, and the Romans were now serious about the fight, Philip made peace overtures to Flaminius. The Roman consul opened negotiations, but was himself unsure of how he wanted to proceed. The consular elections were coming up, and Flaminius, like so many of his predecessors, was worried about some newbie sweeping in and stealing all his glory. He intentionally dragged out the talks, waiting to hear from his allies in the Senate whether his command in Greece would be renewed or given to someone else. If the Senate ordered the new consul for the year to take over, Flaminius planned to cut a quick peace with Philip and return a hero. If he was kept on as proconsul, however, he would end talks and plan for a new campaign the next year. He made all kinds of excuses to explain the slow pace of negotiations, and even advised Philip to send envoys directly to Rome to speed things along. But it was all to buy time, and soon enough Flaminius got word that the Senate had decided to allow him to continue to lead the war against Philip. With that, peace talks were cut off, and Flaminius readied his army for more fighting. Philip, nonplussed at the whole affair, acquired 25,000 mercenaries in an attempt to match the growing Roman allied force, which now included the full-throated support of the Aetolian League, with a collection of cities that had proved so troublesome to Philip during the First Macedonian War. Numbering somewhere north of 30,000, the Romans met Philip and his army at Cynocephaly in 197 BC. What followed was not just the decisive battle of the war, but one of the most important turning points in the history of the Western world. The waxing of Rome and the waning of Greece was confirmed that day as the maniple system of the Roman legions decimated the Macedonian phalanx. It was one thing for Rome to defeat other Italians and Gauls or Spaniards and North Africans, but Greece had been the home of the premier military powers of the ancient world. Alexander the Great, Sparta, the navy of Athens, all were ahead of their time and irresistible forces on the battlefield. It was unthinkable for the Greeks to lose in battle to foreigners, and yet, at the end of the day, Rome stood triumphant and Greek liberty, despite Flaminius's clever propaganda, was snuffed out once and for all. As I mentioned in episode 14, the Romans had taken the phalanx and modified it to be more maneuverable, more versatile, and allow for independent lines of attack. All of these advantages would come into play at Cynocephaly. The battle itself came about by accident. In 197, Flaminius marched north from Thebes into Macedonian territory looking for Philip. The two armies encountered each other and fought a brief skirmish, but each pulled out to reprovision and find better ground to fight on. By sheer luck, both armies headed in the same direction looking for provisions. However, the Cynocephaly hills divided the two, and they were unaware of each other. The next morning, some of Philip's troops became disoriented in an early fog and marched over the hills. The Romans noticed this sudden appearance of the enemy, and Flaminius ordered some of his cavalry, Numidians now fighting on the side of Rome, to pursue the Macedonians. The cavalry stumbled across Philip's main force, and Flaminius ordered 2,000 troops to press an attack on Philip's camp, forcing the Macedonians to pull up into the hills en masse. After driving off the Roman expeditionary force, Philip ordered his troops to come down a ways from the hills and form in the rigid line of a phalanx for battle. Flaminius had by this time lined up his own troops and led the Roman left personally against the Macedonian right, which was led by Philip. The Macedonian right, with the high ground in their favor, was proving more than a match for Flaminius, but the Macedonian left was having a difficult time lining up on the broken ground, and the Roman right was able to smash through the line before it was formed. At this point, an unnamed Roman officer, on his own initiative, ordered a group of maniples under his command to wheel around and attack the rear of Philip's army. Trapped in their phalanx, the Macedonians were unable to turn to face this new threat, and as soon as the new Roman force hit, the battle turned from a fair fight into a slaughter. Philip was able to slip away, but his army was decimated. The Roman maniples, which formed quicker on rough terrain and were capable of independent action, proved superior to the Greek phalanx, which was only effective on the right terrain, and even then, only if given enough time to form properly. And, of course, once a phalanx was flanked, that's all she wrote. The structural advantage of the Roman maniple system was the decisive element of the battle, which in time would come to symbolize more than just a tactical victory, but mark a critical turning point in history. In a clever move born out of necessity, Flaminius announced that the Roman legions would not garrison Greece. Greece was free, he declared, much to the relieved ears of the Greeks. The truth was that the Romans had not the men nor the money to occupy Greece, but of course the Romans sold the absence of an occupying army in the loftiest moral terms. The Greeks, proud of their historical liberty, were more than happy to go along with the Roman story and thanked Flaminius for setting them free. it would prove to be a peculiar form of freedom, as the Romans had no intention of just allowing the Greeks to go off and do whatever they want. To the Romans, a freed slave still had obligations to his former master. The Greeks, who thought they really were free, began to chafe under the demands from Rome for tribute. The tension between the allegedly free Greeks and the Romans would boil over soon enough, and after 50 years of sporadic fighting, all pretenses would be lifted and Greece would be incorporated as a collection of provinces. The honeymoon period did not last long, and next week, the bitter Aetolian League, denied territorial concessions during the peace negotiations with Philip, would call upon the last best defender of Hellenistic power, Antiochus the Great, to enter Greece and free them from their not yet official bondage. The war with Antiochus would draw the Romans further east, where they would run smack into an enemy they thought they had driven off forever, Hannibal the Great and Terrible. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 25, The Syrian War. Last week, Rome was drawn into the thick of Greek politics and emerged from its brief war with Philip of Macedon, the leading power west of the Aegean. The hero of the Second Macedonian War, Gaius Flaminius, had declared Greece free from foreign interference, to the great joy of the proud Greeks. However, it was a peculiar form of freedom, as Flaminius did not seem to count Rome amongst the foreign powers Greece was free from. Soon enough, the Greeks would begin to look sideways at their liberators, who were fast becoming occupiers. A faction of Greeks, fed up with the Roman presence, would look across the Aegean to the only other power in the Mediterranean who could possibly expel the Romans, the Seleucid Empire of Syria, led by Antiochus the Great. Trouble began in 195 BC, the year after Flaminius' declaration. The Aetolian League, the collection of cities that had been Rome's first allies in Greece, felt they had not received the rewards they deserved for all the help they had given the Romans. All their aid for Rome had been given with the assumption that once they helped clear out Macedon, the Aetolian League would be handed control of Greece, with Rome withdrawing into the role of silent partner. But the generous Romans had not punished their Greek enemies at the bargaining table, and had left the existing power structure in place, granting the Aetolians no more control than they had prior to the war against Philip. Rome was well aware of the Aetolian grievances, and was also well aware that the Aetolians were entering negotiations with Sparta to form an alliance that could then offer itself to Antiochus if the Syrian king agreed to launch an anti-Roman offensive. Hoping to preempt an alliance, Flaminius led a force against Sparta and easily overran the outnumbered Greeks. The move was a tactical victory in the sense that it forestalled an Aetolian-Spartan alliance, but strategically the move backfired, turning Greek public opinion against Rome. If Greece was free, why was a Roman army attacking Sparta? If Greece was free, what was a Roman army doing here in the first place? The public relations crisis only ballooned from there. Friends of Rome in Greece were fast becoming an endangered species. At the same time Rome moved against Sparta, envoys, including the leading citizen of his day, Scipio Africanus, were sent to Antiochus in Syria to convince him to keep out of Greece. The Roman delegates announced their policy of Greek freedom and ordered Antiochus to stay on his side of the Hellespont. Antiochus was amused by these demands, pointing out that if Greece was so free, what were the Romans doing there? It was a fair point, and the Romans had no real answer for it. Antiochus sent the delegation away, telling them flatly that Roman demands regarding Greece were as absurd as Antiochus dictating policy to the Romans in Italy. They would each do well to mind their own business. But before the cordial visit passed into open antagonism, Antiochus greeted the Romans with all the honors due a visiting power. Present also, as a guest of Antiochus, was Hannibal, the scourge of Carthage, now living with the king in exile. In one of the most interesting face-to-face meetings of the ancient world, Scipio and Hannibal found themselves present at a banquet together. Scipio, perhaps needling Hannibal a bit, asked the Carthaginian casually who he thought were the greatest generals in history. Hannibal replied that he placed Alexander first, a choice Scipio heartily seconded. Next, Hannibal, needling the Romans back a bit, announced that Pyrrhus was his choice for second greatest general of all time, pointing out his succession of victories against the Romans. Hannibal then boldly declared that he put himself third on the list. Scipio, who was preparing for the satisfaction of Hannibal acknowledging that he was the better general, was shocked at the choice. How could Hannibal claim he was better than a man who had beaten him? As a way of reminding Hannibal of the outcome at Zama, he asked Hannibal, "And where would you stand if you had actually, you know, beaten me?" Hannibal replied that had he beaten Scipio, he would place himself even above Alexander. A backhanded acknowledgement that beating Scipio would have indeed been a major accomplishment, but that the Roman general did not merit a place amongst the very best of all time. Scipio nursed his wounded ego, no doubt, by remembering that he was dining with the king of Syria as a leading representative of a great power, while Hannibal was dining as little more than a beggar. Who's the best general now, sucker? At the conclusion of the meeting between Syria and Rome, the two powers were at loggerheads. Both sides were being goaded by their allies in Greece to fight it out. The Aetolians were begging Antiochus to drive the Romans out of Greece, and the kingdom of Pergamum was egging Rome into attacking its neighbor Antiochus. Hannibal told the Syrian king he would gladly lead an invasion of Italy himself if given the troops and supplies. But no direct confrontation was forthcoming, so the Aetolians decided to press the issue by launching simultaneous attacks on three Roman allied Greek cities, each of which would serve as a safe point of entry for any Syrian army. They were repulsed in two of the cities, but welcomed by the citizens of Demetrius, who were fed up with the Roman presence. This action, coupled with the fact that the Romans were showing signs of stepping back from Greece, convinced Antiochus that the time was ripe for an invasion. He gathered 10,000 troops and sailed for Demetrius. When he arrived, however, two facts became immediately apparent. First, the Aetolians had painted a somewhat misleading picture of the reception Antiochus would receive. Greeted not as a welcome liberator, Antiochus was treated as just another foreign invader and found the gates of Greece closed to his army. Second, Roman interest in Greece was waning only as long as no other power stepped into the vacuum. The arrival of the Syrians triggered an immediate Roman response. Two legions were mustered and sailed for Epirus, where they landed and began a march straight for the invaders, who were camped on the Aegean coast. At the same time, the Achaean League, a rival confederation of the Aetolians, declared for Rome and joined the legions. Antiochus and his 10,000 were facing an army that had grown to more than double that size. Knowing he had miscalculated, but unwilling to simply run for it, Antiochus looked around for a nearby spot where the clear numerical superiority of the Romans would be negated and settled on the most famous bottleneck in history, Thermopylae. 300 Spartans had stood against 2 million Persians, right? So 10,000 versus 20,000 would be a pretty safe bet. Except the Syrians were not the Spartans, the Romans were not the Persians, and everyone and their mother knew by now that there were ways of getting around the narrow pass. It may have looked good on paper, or I guess I should say papyrus, but when the Romans arrived, this battle of Thermopylae had none of the luster of the original. Roman victory was quick and decisive. Antiochus fled back across the Hellespont, and the Romans, smelling blood, came fast on his heels. The one lasting legacy of this battle of Thermopylae was the entrance of Cato the Elder onto history's stage. The man who would dominate Roman politics for the next 50 years made a name for himself leading the charge around the rear of the Syrian army that proved to be the critical maneuver of the battle. Cato, the great conservative of his time, would be the leading defender of old Roman virtue and find himself constantly at odds with Scipio Africanus, who represented the modern Roman man, Hellenized and worldly. Cato fought a losing battle against the evolution of the Roman character, but was idolized by future generations who longed for the simple stoicism of a now largely mythical golden age they held out in contrast to the modern corrupt state they lived with. In 190 BC, adopting a clearly aggressive stance toward Antiochus, the Romans elected as consul Gnaeus Scipio, the brother of Scipio Africanus, and sent the two brothers to Greece to pursue what policies they would. The Scipiones, notoriously bold, did not waste time and took their armies across the Hellespont, leading the Romans into Asia Minor for the first time. As this was occurring, in the south, Hannibal, who had for reasons of court jealousy been left out of Antiochus's general staff, was relegated to commanding a small fleet of ships engaged with the Roman ally Rhodes off the coast of Asia Minor. The great commander, whose talents were clearly wasted, was unable to pry victory from the jaws of defeat and found himself routed by the Rhodesian navy. Who knows what would have happened if Antiochus had allowed Hannibal to lead his forces into Greece or placed him at the head of the army that was about to be annihilated by the Scipione brothers. Maybe Roman inertia would have proved too much to overcome, but then again, maybe the Carthaginian general could have played a role in keeping the Romans bottled up in the west. Certainly, leaving Hannibal on the bench was not a move that served Antiochus well. The decisive battle came at Magnesia, on the border between Pergamum and Syria, in modern-day Turkey, where Antiochus had gathered 70,000 Syrian and mercenary troops. Against this force marched 50,000 Italians and a mixture of Greek allies. The numerical superiority of the Syrians was easily offset by the far greater talent of the Romans. The undertrained Syrians lacked the hard-nosed professionalism of the Romans, and the outcome of the battle was never in doubt. Antiochus's army was crushed, and the disparity between the two supposedly equal powers was thrown out into the open. With a victorious and practically unscathed Roman army standing triumphant deep in Asia Minor, the truth became apparent. Rome had no equal in the Mediterranean. The terms Rome laid at the feet of Antiochus were harsh. A huge cash payment was demanded, hostages of the ruling families were taken back to Rome, and the Syrian king agreed to never again cross the Taurus Mountains, which stood between Anatolia and the mainland Middle East. This range became the de facto frontier of the rapidly expanding Roman Empire. Though Greece and Asia Minor would not be incorporated as official provinces for years, Roman rule in the region was never again in doubt. It was a Roman world. The Greeks just lived in it. The outcome of the war seems like it should have been another feather in the cap of Scipio, but instead it became the source of a great bitterness that would fill the Roman general for the rest of his life. Upon returning to Rome, the Scipione brothers were accused by Cato and his allies of misappropriating war funds. While not denying the charges, Scipio asked if anyone present was dissatisfied with the fact that Rome was making back five times what it had put into the war, because of the indemnity forced on Antiochus by the two brothers. Anyone? Anyone? The brothers were off the hook for a while, but charges were raised again 5 years later. In a bit of poor planning by the opposition, however, the charges against Scipio were brought on the anniversary of the Battle of Zama, and public support for Scipio was at an all-time high. He was never convicted of anything, but the affair left a bad taste in the general's mouth. Retiring to an estate in Campania, he died in 183 BC. The epitaph of his tomb allegedly read, "Ungrateful fatherland, you will not even have my bones." He never did deny the charges, though. Next week, Rome will face deja vu all over again. After the deaths of Philip V and Antiochus the Great, their sons would pick up the mantle and challenge Rome in the field. Having not yet felt the sting of defeat, the brash young kings would soon enough find themselves as beaten and demoralized as their fathers. Fighting Rome was nothing if not a death blow to the ego. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 26, The Third Macedonian War. Having soundly beaten Macedon and Syria, the last two major powers in the east, Rome was now the dominant force in the Mediterranean, a distinction it would hold for the next 700-odd years. In the years after the Syrian War, the Romans were wrapped up with Gallic revolts in the Po Valley and persistent unrest in Spain. Though these territories had been officially conquered, the Romans found it as difficult to maintain their position in these territories as it had been to establish it in the first place. But for the most part, these were mere skirmishes in the wider scope of Mediterranean politics. The real center of attention remained Greece, where, like in Spain and Gaul, winning the prize was not the same as keeping the prize. Yes, the Romans had demonstrated the superiority of their arms, and even the superiority of their diplomatic corps, but the fiercely independent Greeks would never passively stand by as a foreign power held final say over their lives. Rome had its allies, most notably the kingdom of Pergamum in Asia Minor, but the majority of Greeks bristled at the presence of the barbarians from the west. Factions of nobles in most of the important cities schemed constantly to carve out as much autonomy as they could, with an eye on eventually throwing off the Roman yoke. Greece was, after all, the oldest and greatest civilization on earth. Surely Roman rule was merely temporary, and in time the Greeks would retake their place as the leaders of civilization. Right? In Macedon, Philip V had been put squarely in his place, and for all his pride and ambition, he was able to do little about his sorry state after being defeated at Cynocephaly. Though he hated Rome, he was a broken man who could not muster the energy for a full-scale revolt. That task would be left to his son, who would return the bravado and swagger to Macedon and renew their quest to drive the Italians from Greece forever. The catalyst of the Third Macedonian War was Philip V's death in 179 BC, which was, by all accounts, directly related to a quarrel between his two sons, Perseus and Demetrius. After the peace between Macedon and Rome, young Demetrius, Philip's second son, had been sent to Rome as a hostage. Years spent in the city had left the young prince with a pro-Roman worldview. Perseus feared that the political leanings of his younger brother would manifest upon their father's death, that Rome would engineer a coup and Perseus would be denied his rightful throne while Demetrius ruled a puppet kingdom for Rome. So, when Demetrius returned to Macedon in 180 BC, Perseus moved quickly against his brother, convincing Philip that Demetrius was guilty of treason and was plotting with Rome to install himself as king. Philip allowed himself to be swayed and reluctantly ordered the execution of his son. Despite his belief that he had no choice, Philip never recovered from Demetrius's death, and within a year, the old king was dead. This left Perseus in control and Rome concerned about their eastern flank. The Macedonian king kept testing Roman patience, clearly violating the treaty his father had signed by taking control of neighboring territory outside Macedon proper and opening diplomatic relations with the Greek political syndicates. Most worrisome to Rome, Perseus arranged marriage to the daughter of Seleucus IV, who had succeeded his father Antiochus the Great as king of Syria. The Senate hoped for the best, though, and, weary of war and unwilling to embrace a belligerent stance, they turned a blind eye to Perseus's actions. The alliance between the two great Greek powers was a cause of concern in the Senate, but even more so for the kingdom of Pergamum, Rome's steadfast ally, whose territory bordered both Syria and Macedon. Envoys from Pergamum began to send dispatches detailing the outrages and offenses of Perseus, begging Rome to do something about the young upstart king of Macedon. Rome ignored the threat for as long as they could, but finally Illyria began to rise in revolt against Rome, and the common belief was that Perseus was behind the violence. That, coupled with an assassination attempt against the king of Pergamum, sealed the deal, and in 172 BC, legions were sent back across the Adriatic. At first, the Romans simply moved into Illyria to quell the uprising and stood on the border of Macedon. But a year later, war was officially declared, and the legions headed into Macedon under the command of Licinius Crassus, an ancestor of the famous triumvir, who would join with Julius Caesar and Pompey in their fatal three-way alliance a century later. This Crassus did not get his familial legacy off to a great start, and promptly led the Romans to their first defeat in Greece. It was a minor engagement, to be sure, but the propaganda value of the loss was a boon to Perseus, and Greek leaders who had kept their distance from an open conflict with Rome began to throw their support to Macedon. It was a decision that would haunt a lot of them and lead not to freedom, but to the obliteration of freedom. After direct confrontation with the Macedonians had proved to be more difficult than the Romans thought, the next 2 years saw the Roman army in the east turn toward more profitable and less dangerous pursuits, the plunder of defenseless Greek towns. The consuls in charge during these 2 years seem to have had little ability or desire to control their men, and the legions became little more than a highly efficient band of marauders. A great deal of wealth, plunder, and slaves were hauled back to Rome. Everyone profited, so discipline went out the window. This, coupled with the behind-the-scenes maneuvering of Perseus, turned even more Greeks against Rome. There was little to be gained by standing with the Romans now. The Italian brutes had no interest in governing, or, indeed, the lives of Greeks in general. They just wanted to ransack the countryside. In 168 BC, the new consul for the year was Aemilius Paulus, the son of the Paulus who had tried to halt the Battle of Cannae before it happened, and then died leading his troops into the massacre. More disciplined than the previous consuls, Paulus the Younger immediately restored a sense of purpose to the troops, reminding them that they were there to fight as soldiers against an army, not thieve from innocent Greeks, who were, after all, nominally under Roman protection, if that was not a complete contradiction in terms by now. Paulus located the army of Perseus and announced his intention to make for the Macedonian army and defeat them. Perseus was well positioned with 40,000 troops on the Aegean coast, and dislodging him would take some doing. Paulus ordered one of his generals to take a chunk of the army and make a lot of noise approaching Perseus from the north. This maneuver convinced the Macedonians that the main Roman army would follow, and they prepared for an invasion from the north. However, as soon as darkness fell, the Roman expeditionary force kept right on walking and swung around behind the Greeks. Only the timely intervention of a Roman deserter alerted Perseus to the danger. 12,000 Greeks were sent down to block the Romans coming up now from the south, but they were driven back in disarray. Realizing he was being encircled and unsure of where the rest of the Romans actually were, Perseus broke north out of his fortified position and set himself up near the village of Pydna, where the open, flat country would ensure the proper deployment of his phalanx. Having flushed out his prey, Paulus immediately recombined his force and marched to meet Perseus. After spending the night camped across the plain from each other, the two sides rose the next morning, eager to have it out. According to legend, Paulus, facing east, stalled his deployment until the afternoon, when the sun would be in the eyes of the Macedonians. Whether this is true or not is a matter of debate, but it is true that the battle did not start until the afternoon, and despite the evenly matched sizes of the two armies, things quickly got away from Perseus. Whether or not the sun played any role is, again, a matter of debate. The Greek phalanx pushed the Romans back initially, which was good, but they pushed the Romans back onto uneven hills bordering the plain, which was bad. The phalanx began to splinter, and the Romans were able to send individual maniples through the breaks in the Macedonian line, and not so much flank the Macedonians as eat them from the inside out. The Macedonian left disintegrated, and Perseus fled with his cavalry. Of the 40,000 or so Greeks in the Macedonian army, at least 25,000 died at Pydna, while the Romans lost maybe 1,000. 5,000 Greeks were captured along with Perseus himself. Where his father had managed to negotiate a peace that left him in control of Macedon, Perseus received no such favors. The young king was paraded through Roman chains at Paulus's triumph, and then banished to exile in a small Italian village where he lived a miserable existence and died in obscurity. And he showed such promise. The defeat at Pydna marked the end of the Macedonian kingdom, whose holdings under Alexander had once extended all the way to India. The Senate broke the kingdom up into four republics, which were forbidden to trade directly with one another or any other Greek city. All economic activity had to be brokered by Rome. This ensured that no undue consolidation of riches or power occurred, and that the Romans would never have to deal with trouble in Macedon again. Weak and divided, the Macedonians would attempt one last-ditch effort for independence years later, but that would merely present the Romans with an opportunity to officially incorporate the territory into the province of Macedonia. Returning to Rome, Paulus, who had done so much to end the senseless pillaging of the legions, led his army on one of the great sadistic rampages of the ancient world. Passing through Epirus, the Romans, furious at the Greeks in general for turning on Rome, decided that an example had to be made of someone to prevent this sort of thing from happening in the future. They chose Epirus because it was convenient, even though the locals had nothing to do really with Perseus or his war against the Romans. At first, Paulus implied that if he was paid off, Epirus would be spared, and the 70 or so towns collected as much as they could and handed it willingly to the Romans. But the minute Paulus had collected it all, he simply let his men off their leashes and let them sack, rape, plunder, and burn anyone and anything they came across. Over 150,000 locals were bound up and sold into slavery. The rest were killed and left destitute or homeless. It was a harsh lesson for the Greeks, harsher still for the relative innocence of Epirus. After driving off Philip and proclaiming freedom for Greece, the Romans were universally loved. But now, a mere 30 years later, that love was gone, replaced with fear. Machiavelli's point that it is better to be feared than loved is backed up by the Roman experience in Greece. Loved, the Romans dealt constantly with backstabbing and conspiracies to do away with them. Feared, the Romans ruled in peace and unchallenged. There is no accounting for the horror and immorality on display in Epirus, but the cold fact remains that it worked. Future Greeks knew what the wrath of Rome meant, and they wanted no part of it. Better to drink wine and tutor the Romans in math and philosophy than attempt to cross swords with them. One of the other legacies left to us by the Roman victory in the Third Macedonian War was the transportation of a great number of Greek hostages to Rome, including a young scholar named Polybius. Taken in by the family of Aemilius Paulus, Polybius would become the instructor of Paulus's son, Scipio Aemilianus, who would grow up to be one of the most famous and influential of all Roman statesmen, and really, the last of the great political figures who was not connected to the crises that would consume the Republic in the next century. In an attempt to explain to his fellow Greeks who the Romans were and where they came from, Polybius constructed a massive history of Rome, which exists largely intact today and stands as one of the pillars of our own understanding of Rome. The histories of Polybius have, indeed, played an integral part in our very own History of Rome podcast, and we owe him a great debt for his excellent work. Next week, we will return for the last time to Carthage and Macedon. The two great enemies who had so consumed the Romans for the last century were beaten. But for Rome, it would not be enough to simply beat them. They had to be crushed. Cato the Elder had made a point of ending every speech before the Senate, whatever the topic, be it garbage collection or loan repayment, with the line, "Furthermore, it is my opinion that Carthage must be destroyed." Cato, like many of his countrymen, feared the return of Carthage and so set out to annihilate once and for all their nemesis from Africa, and quite literally, sow their fields with salt. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, Episode 27, Mopping Up. For the last 100 years, Rome had been consumed by two major theaters of war, North Africa and Greece. The struggles against Carthage and Macedon had become intergenerational affairs, and now the grandsons and great-grandsons of the men who had initially declared the wars donned their armor to finally finish the job. The years just after 150 BC would mark the end of resistance on both fronts. Not that the final act played out the same in both theaters, however. In Greece, a pretender to the Macedonian throne would openly court conflict, whereas in North Africa, the Carthaginians did everything they could to prevent another war with Rome. In both cases, though, the results would be the same, and in the watershed year of 146 BC, both Carthage and the great Greek city of Corinth would burn to the ground after being lit by Roman torches. There would be no more mistaking who ruled the Mediterranean. In that year, the Roman Empire was truly born. In the years leading up to 146, Greece, the dominant focus of Rome for the last 50 years, still existed in a state of relative independence. The Romans did not wish to garrison the whole country, and hoped that the example made of Epirus would instill in the Greeks a self-control that would leave the Romans free from military costs in the east. It was not to be, however. The dream of Greek freedom burnt as bright as ever, forcing the Romans to conclude that there could be no half-measures in Greece. Trouble began in 150 BC when a pretender to the Macedonian throne named Andriscus appeared with the intention of reuniting Macedon and throwing the Romans out. He claimed to be the son of vanquished Perseus and the grandson of Philip V, the last great king of Macedon. Without a strong Roman military presence in Greece, Andriscus followed the path of his alleged father and started to push the boundaries of Roman patience. At the end of the Third Macedonian War, the country had been divided into four republics, economically and politically cut off from one another. Andriscus worked to secretly reunite the territories and began forming an army to deal with inevitable Roman pushback. However, with efforts in his home territory moving slowly, Andriscus took what soldiers he had and marched south, conquering Thessaly, and then returned to Macedon with some momentum, which he was able to use to unite the four republics under his banner. Rome did not look kindly on this and sent a force to deal with the revolt. But the Romans underestimated the resistance they would face, and the small expeditionary army was repelled by the Macedonians. Andriscus was starting to feel pretty good about himself, but his success was made possible only by the disinterest of the Roman Senate and an ineffectual response. Reports of the Macedonian victory changed all that, and a new army was sent, this one at full strength and under the command of a brilliant general named Quintus Metellus. That he would soon be called Quintus Metellus Macedonicus should let you know that Andriscus's luck was not long for the world. Metellus marched into Macedon and crushed Andriscus and the Macedonian army without much effort. Whatever steam the Macedonians had been building proved to be just that, a lot of hot air, and they proved not even close to a match for a truly committed Roman army. The pretender was driven off and captured, sharing the fate of his alleged father, and paraded through Rome in Metellus's triumph. The Senate finally wised up to the fact that their hands-off oversight of Macedon was an unsustainable policy, and so Macedon, along with Epirus, were incorporated into the Roman Empire as official provinces, the first extension of Roman sovereignty into Greece. Not long after the Macedonians were pacified, another flare of Greek defiance was fired off, this time from Corinth, the leading city of the Achaean League. Metellus was recalled to Rome to receive his triumph, and in his place the consul Lucius Mummius was sent to command the Greek forces. That he would soon be called Lucius Mummius Achaeus should let you know that Corinthian luck was not long for this world either. In an absolutely brutal display of power, Corinth was besieged, overcome, and burned to the ground. The men were slaughtered, and the women and children sold into slavery. The razing of Corinth marked the total ascension of Roman power in Greece. In a few years, the territory would join Macedonia and Epirus as full Roman provinces. Greek freedom was a dead issue. Running concurrently to the events in Greece, and one of the principal reasons for the initial indifferent response to Macedonian agitation, was the last act of the great struggle with Carthage. Unlike the Greeks, however, the Carthaginians were simply minding their own business when the Roman Senate decided Carthage must be destroyed. After the Battle of Zama, the war party in Carthage was ousted from power, exemplified by the exile of Hannibal. The Carthaginians at heart were merchants and traders. Prosecuting endless wars of empire was not really in their genetic makeup. The period after the Second Punic War was, for the Carthaginians, a return to their true calling, making lots and lots of money. Forced by Rome to dissolve its army, Carthage found its ledgers now free of an enormous yearly debit. The money was invested in more productive endeavors, endeavors that actually produced a monetary return. Soon Carthage was riding high, economically at least, which filled the Romans with a mixture of envy and dread. Unwilling to relieve the Carthaginians of their debt and the subservience that came with it, the Romans rejected offers for the war indemnity to be paid in one lump sum, a sum that the Carthaginians could now easily afford. The Carthaginian Senate kept trying to bribe the Romans with free shipments of grain, but Rome insisted on paying for all goods that arrived from Carthage so as not to appear in any way indebted to the Carthaginians. Now, during these years, the dominant political power in North Africa had become Numidia, led by the loyal Roman ally Massinissa, who had been with them since the final days of the Second Punic War. In the decades after Zama, Massinissa had led the Numidians into Carthaginian territory numerous times and had peeled off more and more land with each invasion. The Romans were officially neutral, but obviously they had no problem with the Numidians stealing Carthaginian land. By the 150s BC, however, Carthaginian appeasement of Roman power had once again become a hot-button issue. The Carthaginians were supposed to have retained their North African holdings under the terms of the peace treaty, and Rome was supposed to act as a protector of those terms. But clearly Rome was allowing the Numidians to run amok and had no intention of looking out for Carthaginian interests. So the peace party in Carthage was ousted in favor of a more aggressive faction. The new party did not advocate war with Rome. They merely sought to raise an army to defend Carthage, which was, technically, a violation of the peace terms, but Rome had already violated the terms by not protecting Carthage from attack. Plus, the last installments of the indemnity were sent to Rome, and many in Carthage believed this released them of any further obligations to Rome. In 151 BC, the Numidians crossed once again into Carthaginian territory and laid siege to a border city. Carthage raised an army of 25,000 to defend the city and lift the siege. After 50 years of peace, however, it could have been 500,000, and the result probably would have been the same. The 25,000 green recruits were easily crushed by the seasoned Numidians, and for their trouble, all the Carthaginians really did was give the Romans an excuse to destroy them once and for all. When word came that a Carthaginian army had taken the field, Cato the Elder and his cohorts persuaded the Senate that Carthage was once again on the rise and would remain forever a threat to Rome if it was not utterly destroyed. The Senate agreed, and in 149 BC ordered a massive invasion force of 80,000 to North Africa. When they arrived, the Carthaginians attempted at once to come to terms, but Roman demands were too harsh. They demanded that the Carthaginians abandon their city and move no less than 10 miles inland. Flabbergasted by this insane demand, the Carthaginian envoys rejected the terms. Once again, just as in the First Punic War, Carthaginian envoys had failed to give up. This time, though, Xanthippus would not be around to bail them out. The Romans were all set to take the city by force, but disease ripped through the lines, and the legions became so weakened that the Romans had to settle for a siege. 2 years passed in inconclusive misery for both sides, when the Senate realized the mistake they had made. Clearly the fact that the only Roman general who had ever been successful in Africa was a Scipio meant that they needed to appoint a Scipio to head the legions. So they elected as consul Scipio Aemilianus, by blood the son of Paulus, who had defeated Perseus in the Third Macedonian War, but by adoption the grandson of Scipio Africanus. Scipio Aemilianus only further cemented the Roman superstition that only Scipios could emerge victorious from Africa. Arriving near the end of 147 BC, he immediately blockaded the harbor and laid waste to the countryside. By the time the spring of 146 BC rolled around, the Carthaginians were at their wits' end. But again, Roman terms began and ended with the abandonment of the city, and so, despite their desperate situation, the Carthaginians continued to resist. Finally, Scipio ordered a full attack, and the walls were breached. What followed was 6 days of intense street fighting, as the Carthaginians forced the Romans to fight for every block. The overmatched Carthaginians were finally pushed back into their citadel, and the Romans ran loose in the city. By this point, of the 700,000 citizens of Carthage, only about 50,000 remained. Everyone else was either dead, enslaved, or had fled. The great city was in the midst of its death throes. Finally, the citadel was breached, and the last of the Carthaginians were captured or killed. Against his own wishes, but acting at the Senate's instructions, Scipio set fire to the city, which, according to legend, took 10 days to burn. Survivors, of whom there were too many to take back to Rome as slaves, were forced to live with the mandate they had fought so hard against. Carthage was not to be rebuilt, and no settlements were allowed within 10 miles of the coast. The days of life at the vital hub of Mediterranean trade was at an end. It was a life of meager subsistence for the descendants of a power that had once upon a time nearly destroyed the Roman Empire. According to further legend, the Romans then plowed the fields around Carthage with salt so that nothing could ever grow there again. The story only emerged in later years, so it is doubtful that it actually happened, but the account gained widespread acceptance and served as a cautionary tale for future generations. Along with the burning of Corinth, the destruction of Carthage was forever offered as a possible scenario to people who resisted Rome. These are not idle threats, the Romans would remind their enemies. This is our history. Now, where would you like us to stick that garrison again? With overseas provinces sprouting up all over the place, in Sicily, in Spain, Africa, and Greece, the Roman Empire as we think of it was beginning to form into its recognizable shape. With Carthage destroyed and Greece pacified, there were no great powers left to really challenge Rome's dominance. Tribes in Spain would harass the Romans endlessly, and Gallic hordes remained a constant threat. But for the most part, the hard part of winning the empire had been completed. It is at this point, and I like to mark 146 BC with a mental pushpin, that the Romans lost a critical unifying force, a worthy opponent. From this point forward, Roman competitiveness and ambition began to turn inward, and many of its leading citizens began to look for enemies to fight not outside of the empire, but within it. In the years after 146, Rome would be consumed with internal strife, from the class conflicts egged on by the Gracchi brothers, to the revolt of the Italian allies, to the civil war between Marius and Sulla, and then the greater civil war between the Caesars and the Senate. Roman history would return to the Italian peninsula after years abroad. There will of course be excursions back to Africa and into Gaul with Julius Caesar, but the long period of a unified Roman people holding fast against foreign threats is at an end. Next week, we will return to the city and take stock of the situation. How were the plebeians faring? How much land did the great landowners now own? Was the Senate a representative body at all anymore, or had it become a law unto itself? Rome was now rich and powerful. To what lengths would men go for a piece of it? What was the result of the massive influx of slave labor into Italy? By the way, if you answered a best supporting actor for Peter Ustinov to that last one, you're right. So strap into your seats. The next 100 years are going to be quite a roller coaster. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, Episode 28, Taking Stock. For 350 years, the Roman Republic had grown, contracted, grown again, survived, and thrived. Through it all, the Romans never turned away from their most basic founding principle, that no king shall reign in Rome. Every year men stood for election, and every year free ballots were cast by free citizens. The winners won and the losers lost, and power was transferred peacefully between them. At no point did the great and ambitious leaders of Rome step outside the bounds of the system to seize control of the state. It is a remarkable run, and the Republic's track record was and is the cause of much justifiable envy. But alas, the Romans, for all their strength on the battlefield and all their moral rectitude, could not stem the tide of greed and ambition that lurks in the hearts of men in all times and all places. Roman success would be the undoing of the Roman Republic, and after the symbolic dual sacking of Carthage and Corinth in 146 BC, the dam holding back the dark side began to crack visibly. Less than a century later, the dam would break, and in defiance of all that had once been held as good and true by the Romans, a single man would ascend to the throne of power, and though he was wise enough not to call himself king, we all know that a rose by any other name would still smell as sweet. For all these years, the Republic had survived for two major overarching reasons. The lower class plebeians had not been so impoverished that they were driven to violent revolution to improve their material lot in life, and the upper class was unified enough that their internal rivalries did not spill out into the public sphere. both of these critical linchpins were about to be removed, leaving civil war and violent class conflict as the order of the day. And both linchpins were pulled by the very same hand, victory overseas. The Romans, in addition to the entire peninsula of Italy, now controlled Sicily, Sardinia, North Africa, Greece, Macedon, and Spain. All those subject lands provided the Romans with wealth never before imagined, slaves in the hundreds of thousands, and endless opportunities for personal enrichment. One might imagine that with such an abundance flooding into Rome, that there would be far less internal conflict, not more. There would be more than enough to go around. What would be the point of squabbling? The problem, though, was that all the new wealth was winding up in the hands of the already wealthy elites, and some became so rich that, in effect, they considered the cohesion of the state less important than they had in the past. When you are completely self-financed, there is a tendency to follow your own whims and everyone else be damned. And this, to put it mildly, is no way to keep a free republic running smoothly. The ruling class, which had for all these centuries understood that patrician solidarity kept them firmly in charge, started to see men break off to make their own way in the world, forcing the others to compete or lose what status they had. Things quickly spiraled out of control. In a way, it can all be traced back to Scipio Africanus, the long-haired, flamboyant, irreverently religious hero of the Second Punic War, set an example for ambitious young Romans to follow. Indeed, it was Scipio who originally coined the term imperator when his troops hailed him as a king after his victories in Spain. Scipio, like Augustus, was savvy enough to distance himself from all talk of monarchy, but the cult of personality he encouraged set the tone for future threats to the Republic. And after being dispatched to the east to deal with Antiochus, Scipio also showed later Roman leaders how to form independent power bases and self-finance a good old-fashioned power grab. A long, long time ago, I briefly touched on the idea that class struggles in Rome never manifested on strict economic lines because of the entrenchment of the client-patron model of civic relations. All Scipio did was transfer this model to Roman dealings with other nations. To recap briefly, wealthy Roman patricians offered all manner of services to their poorer fellow citizens, most notably bank loans and legal representation. In exchange for this aid, the citizen reciprocated by backing their patrons in elections and showering them with public support anytime the patron required it. It may seem a minor thing, but in Rome much rested on a man's ability to turn out favorable crowds if he ever came under political or judicial attack. The client-patron relationships endured through generations and wound up providing many of the social services we now ask of the state, the equivalent of healthcare, welfare, and old age pensions. These bonds were strong enough to bind families to voting against their own immediate interests in favor of their patron's chosen policy. Not to jump ahead, but when a conflict between rival patrons heated up, each had an army ready to fight blindly for their man. All Scipio did was extend this principle to his overseas dealings, leaving behind him a wake of noble families in Spain, North Africa, and Greece, personally loyal to him rather than the Roman Senate per se. Indeed, it was the source of all his troubles with Cato after the Scipiones returned from the east having defeated Antiochus. Scipio had granted favors to the Syrian king in exchange for certain monetary tribute, which, on the one hand, was obviously bribery, but on another, it was simply an extension of the client-patron model. Could a patron deny his client a favor? Why, it would be rude to do such a thing. Flaminius, after pacifying Greece, took the same attitude, and soon Roman aristocrats stationed overseas began to cultivate complex networks of foreign clients, which brought enormous prestige to the Roman aristocrat in question. Slowly but surely, patricians stationed in the provinces began to outpace their fellow elites in terms of wealth, power, and fame. Almost overnight, the game had changed. Other patricians were forced to keep up with the Joneses or risk being left behind, and competition was fierce for the critical overseas appointments that afforded these newfound sources of status. Cato and his faction were hyper-aware of the danger this posed to the state. If some amongst the patricians became more equal than others, then the cohesion of the ruling class would fall away, and they would all end up poorer men at the end of the day. It may even lead, horror of horrors, to the plebeians taking advantage of the situation and imposing reforms on a divided ruling class. Sumptuary laws were even passed, making ostentatious displays of wealth a crime. It was an attempt to erect a superficial facade strong enough to cut the dangerous competition for riches to a minimum, but it was nearly impossible to enforce, and plus, everyone knew how much everyone was making anyway. No law about what material your shirt could be made of was going to change that. So on the one hand, Rome's emergence as the dominant political force in the Mediterranean would have disastrous consequences for the ruling class. Too much money went to the heads of too many young men, and immediate personal ambition took the place of long-term political stability. On the other hand, it also had disastrous consequences for the average Roman in the street, or at least the average Roman in the field. The backbone of the Republic had always been the free citizen farmer soldier, the man who owned enough land to meet the property requirements for service in the legion, who would fight or farm depending on what his country asked him to do. But after conquering half the known world, these citizen soldiers came home to find that Italy had been transformed and they were left out in the economic cold. In the years after the conquest of Greece, the large landowners began to buy up neighboring farms. Sometimes the smallholders sold willingly, sometimes they had to be persuaded. But the upshot was that more and more land was owned by fewer and fewer families. Of course, large estates were nothing new to Rome, but even if the title was held by some patrician, he needed free men to till the earth, and if it wasn't quite as satisfying a life, at least a poor farmer could get along. But that was all about to change. After sweeping through Spain, Africa, and Greece, the legions brought home with them slaves, slaves by the thousands, then the tens of thousands, then the hundreds of thousands. Suddenly, the largest state owners did not need free Roman citizens for the planting, or for the harvest, or really for anything. Now slaves ran the farms, and tilled the soil, and carried the bushels. The profit margins were outrageous. How could a savvy patrician pass up the opportunity to reduce his labor costs to zero? Besides, his rival in the Senate was doing the same thing, so Senator Smith just had to keep up with Senator Jones. It was not outsourcing so much as insourcing. The jobs stayed right where they were. It was the people who were forced to leave. Suddenly, once fine upstanding members of the community were landless, homeless, and growing desperate. Most migrated to the cities where they hoped to learn a trade, or to the provinces where they attempted to become traders, or, if they were lucky, secure a small holding abroad. The pressure this put on Roman society was intense. Certainly a few sold their farms for a hefty profit and found a new line of work, but most simply fell on hard times. The Roman economy, which had once been merely supplanted by slave labor, was now a full-blown slave economy, and the free citizens struggled to stay afloat. One of the most important consequences this had for the Republic was the makeup of its army. I will talk more about this when we get to the episodes about Marius and his mules, but the property requirements that men had to meet in order to be enrolled in the legions were fast becoming unattainable. If the requirements were what they had been in Camillus's time, the Romans would be marching out an army consisting of a dozen or so young nobles. Out of necessity, the requirements were lowered and lowered again to keep the legions at full strength. But with more and more families pushed off the land, it was difficult to keep up. Finally, around 100 BC, the property requirements were eliminated and the recruiting offices were thrown open to any man who wished to join. Of course, the soldier, lacking any other means of enrichment, would have to be paid. And pay was dependent on his commander's ability to secure booty. And if a commander got really good at seizing booty, there were thousands of morally flexible armed Romans who would flock to his banner. This wasn't about leaving behind the plow to fight for the family plot anymore. This was mercenary work in the guise of state policy. And it did not take long for the facade to fall away. The properties that had bound the Roman Republic together were coming unglued. The Senate, which had risen to a state of political preeminence during the long years of the Second Punic War, was deaf to the ill winds that were blowing. Each senator was caught up in their own quest for personal glory, What cash crop should I plant this year? Sure, famine is beginning to rear its ugly head, but I hear olives are fetching a fine price in Athens. Besides, I need to make enough to ensure that my son gets that quaestorship, and the wheels need to be greased a little, if you know what I mean. The ruling class was consumed with this kind of thinking, little realizing that it was about to all come crashing down on their heads. The problem was that the republic had stopped functioning as a republic and had passed into true oligarchy. But the people had not forgotten what they once had, and were fast becoming desperate enough to use any means necessary to get a piece of the pie back. And the slow slide from oligarchy into tyranny truly began when some of the nobles began to realize that all they had to do was promise the masses a piece of that pie, and they themselves could have the whole world. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, Episode 29, Tiberius Gracchus. Last week, I partially summed up the domestic, political, and economic situation in Rome after the final victories of 146 BC. With the destruction of Carthage, Rome transitioned from what we now call the Middle Republican period into the Late Republican period. And even if you know nothing else about Roman history, you probably know that the late Republican history was a time of intense turmoil. Today, we will enter the endgame of the Roman Republic, and the first move will be made by Tiberius Sempronius Gracchus. Tiberius was born in 168 BC to Tiberius Gracchus the Elder in Cornelia Africana. His father was a well-respected member of the ruling elite. Though a pleb by birth, by this time the distinction between patrician and pleb was less important than it had been in the past, and the elder Gracchus was an upstanding defender of the old order. Over the course of his career, he had been tribune of the plebs, censor, and twice consul. When he was tribune, the elder Gracchus had taken sides with Scipio Africanus during the political battle over the great general's actions in the east and played a decisive role in securing an acquittal. In gratitude for this loyalty, Gracchus was given one of Scipio's daughters, Cornelia, in marriage. The match was unusual for the age difference, Gracchus at this point being 45 and Cornelia only 18, and also for the fact that there seemed to be genuine affection between them, something that was usually lacking from the political marriages of the upper class. Gracchus the Elder died in 154 BC when young Tiberius was only 14. Even up to that point, the father had spent much of his life in service to Rome and was a rarely seen figure at the family estate. The education of the boy, as well as his brothers and sisters, was overseen by Cornelia, who in later years would be honored as the living embodiment of the true Roman woman, the dutiful daughter of Rome's greatest general, the wife of a consul, and mother of two of the most famous politicians in history. Her frugality and sense of honor and familial duty were lauded for years, and in time she passed from being a living person into a sort of Virgin Mary figure for later Romans. She had three children survive into adulthood, Tiberius, his younger brother Gaius, and their sister Sempronia, who would wed Scipio Aemilianus, sacker of Carthage and the dominant political force of his day. It is not an understatement to say that this particular nuclear family may be the most politically connected in Roman history. The career of Tiberius the Younger began in Carthage when he was attached to the staff of his brother-in-law, and also, I should mention, uncle by way of adoption, Scipio Aemilianus. According to the legend, Tiberius was the first man over the walls of Carthage when the North Africans finally fell to Rome. It goes without saying that this story maybe, just maybe, is an embellishment created later by Tiberius's political supporters. After serving in North Africa, Tiberius was stationed in Spain, which had yet to be incorporated as an official Roman province. I believe I mentioned earlier the irony that Spain, being one of the first territories outside Italy the Romans moved into, was also one of the last to be officially pacified. During this particular period, the 130s BC, there was trouble around Numantia, and Tiberius served in the legions dispatched to break up a revolt. The resulting campaign was a complete disaster, however, and in 137 BC, 20,000 Roman soldiers were captured. Tiberius brokered a deal with the Spanish to secure the freedom of the legionnaires, but when the terms were brought back, the Senate rejected them out of hand, issuing a public rebuking of Tiberius for the dishonorable treaty he had brokered. Critically, the call to reject the treaty came from Scipio Aemilianus, making the rejection personal and embittering. I mentioned last week that after 146 BC, the ruling class began to lose their cohesion. The incident between the Senate and Tiberius Gracchus was an early indication of things to come. Though he was officially plebeian, Gracchus was clearly in the ruling party's camp. But after the stern questioning of his honor by the Senate, Tiberius would break from his colleagues and began to look to the people for political support. He was followed by others in the ruling party, who began to look for ways to exalt themselves above and beyond the Senate by directly appealing to the will of the people. This was the early splintering of Rome into the familiar and famous political parties, the Optimates and the Populares. The Optimates represented the old oligarchic supremacy of the Senate, while the Populares supported reforms that would strip the disproportionate wealth and power that the elites held in their hands. Looking for good guys and bad guys in this division is nearly impossible. During the civil wars, it was the Optimates, Cicero among them, who were the defenders of the Republic, while the Populares advocated for Caesar. But for all their platitudes about Republican virtue, the Optimates were interested merely in protecting their own position, not about protecting Republicanism per se. Defenders of freedom and liberty were everywhere in word, and nowhere indeed during the final century of the Republic. For the next 5 years, Tiberius watched the lot of the Roman people go from bad to worse. Their farms were being bought up, slaves were taking their jobs, and a revolt in Sicily had brought critical grain importation to a standstill. All of this left the average Roman desperate and impoverished, and it left Tiberius Gracchus with a golden political opportunity. In 133 BC, he stood for election as one of the 10 plebeian tribunes for the year. Upon election, Gracchus embarked on one of the most ambitious and controversial tenures in Roman history. It probably would have been the most ambitious and controversial tenure in Roman history had it not been for his brother's even more ambitious and even more controversial tenure a decade later. At the heart of Tiberius's popularity was his calls for aggressive agrarian reform. With all the eloquence his upper-class education afforded him, Gracchus made common cause with the lowly disenfranchised farmer. As I noted last week, the large estates in Italy were growing larger by the day. Tiberius proposed to put a cap on the amount of land that a man could own. The proposal was wildly popular with the people, but how would Tiberius ever get the measure passed by the Senate, who not only hated the bill, but also the man who proposed it? Tiberius sidestepped this problem with a solution that only further enraged the Senate. He would simply bypass them. There was nothing in the law that said measures proposed in the people's assemblies had to be brought to the Senate for approval. It had just been a long-standing working custom. So when Tiberius was elected tribune, he simply made his pitch to the people and figured the rest would take care of itself. Unfortunately for Gracchus, though, by law, any one of his tribunate colleagues could veto the measure, and this was a law, not merely a custom. So the Senate tapped an ally, a tribune named Octavius, who vetoed the measure. No amount of fist-pumping or hand-wringing or demagoguery could change the immutable fact that if another tribune vetoed a proposal, it was a dead issue. Tiberius moved that Octavius be voted out of office, but before that could happen, the vote had to be approved, and Octavius vetoed that too. So Tiberius made a fateful move, ordering his supporters to physically remove Octavius so he could no longer hinder the proceedings. Even Tiberius's supporters worried about the heavy-handed treatment of Octavius. A tribune was, and had been since the inception of the office, sacrosanct, and by law no Roman could lay a hand on a tribune. Only the immense popularity of Gracchus with the people allowed him to commit this utter sacrilege. Tiberius then took things one step further and announced that he was going to veto every bill in sight until he got his way. Even the most trivial measure was cut off without debate. Tiberius brought Rome to a complete standstill. The Senate, seeing the ease with which Tiberius had been able to physically manhandle a state officer and wishing to get the business of business moving again, allowed the reform bill to pass. A three-member commission was established to oversee the redistribution of land, consisting of Tiberius, his younger brother Gaius, and, inexplicably I know, Appius Claudius. I did a double take myself when I first learned that an Appius Claudius was on the side of a radical populist, but it's true. Tiberius had married the man's daughter, and in the Department of Strange Bedfellows, this Appius Claudius did not join the family business of defending patrician rights with his every word and deed. The three sat down and began doling out land. They turned first to the land in Italy that had been held by soldiers who had been killed in battle. Supposedly that land was supposed to revert to the people, but enterprising senators had been occupying the unclaimed plots. The Agrarian Commission set about breaking the plots up and redistributing them. It is estimated that roughly 75,000 new farms were created in that year. Unfortunately, lacking a proper budget, the entire endeavor was marked by inefficiency, confusion, and yes, corruption. Soon enough, though, the question of Italian land took a back burner to an even hotter question. King Attalus III of Pergamum, nephew of the long-standing Roman ally during the Macedonian Wars, Attalus II, died in 133 BC, and, sensing that a dynastic struggle and inevitable Roman conquest would follow, the king willed Pergamum, which is today western Turkey, to the Roman people. The windfall was greeted by cheers in Rome, but pretty soon the question arose as to what exactly the king had meant. The Senate assumed that as responsible stewards of the state, that the land fell under their jurisdiction and would be parceled out and governed by the consuls and proconsuls of the ruling class. Tiberius and his allies, however, read the endowment literally and argued that Pergamum had been left to the people of Rome, and therefore fell under the purview of the Agrarian Commission. Rome was in the midst of a land crisis and had been handed the answer to all of its problems on a silver platter. Settlements for everyone. But by again taking his proposal directly to the people and bypassing the Senate, Tiberius was playing with fire. The enmity between the Senate and Tiberius was deeply personal at this point. It is impossible to know which policies were pursued because they were thought best and which were pursued simply to poke the other side in the eye. The Senate, incensed, decided that the wisest course of action would be to simply wait. Tiberius's year in office would soon be up, and once the shield of sacrosanctity was lifted, they would have their revenge. It was common knowledge that men were lining up around the block with charges they planned to file against Tiberius the moment he stepped down. Tiberius, recognizing that he may have gone too far, too fast, and with much too heavy of a hand, decided to go double or nothing and announced he was running for re-election. This was in clear violation of the proscribed annual term limit, but Tiberius pushed ahead, arguing that if the people's assembly saw fit to return him for another year, who was anyone to deny them that right? This was the last straw for a small cabal of conservative nobles who decided it was time for Tiberius to go. Led by Tiberius's own cousin, and Octavius, the deposed tribune, a group of armed patricians descended on a public rally for Tiberius and ordered the people to disperse and cut off their support for this illegal candidate. The calculated fighting words did their work, and a fight broke out. In the ensuing riot, Tiberius was targeted and clubbed to death. When told of the death of his brother-in-law, Scipio Aemilianus reportedly quoted the Odyssey, saying, "So perish all who do the like again." Tiberius Gracchus had gotten the late Republic off the ground with a bang. His extremism re-energized class struggles that had been dormant for centuries. The reactionary patricians, wrapped up in their own personal disdain for Tiberius the man, failed to see that he fronted a reform movement that had more than its fair share of legitimate grievances. Much of the time they failed to even pay lip service to the suffering of the common Roman family, and succeeded merely in engendering further division. In their stubborn refusal to let go the old order, they practically guaranteed it would be smashed apart. On Tiberius's head, however, was the subsequent wholesale abandonment of long-standing traditions that had bound the state together by ambitious politicians. The removal of the Tribune Octavius was an unprecedented move and, for better or for worse, laid bare before Rome the reality that their laws and traditions were just words, and that they could be broken with impunity if supported by a loud enough mob. The sacrosanctity of the tribunate went all the way back to the secession of the plebs in the first generation of the Republic hundreds and hundreds of years ago. If such a long-standing tradition could be cast aside in the name of political expediency, what did the Republic really have to stand on? It left the Romans without any guidelines, markers, rules, or boundaries. The next century would unfold as little more than a political free-for-all. Power was everyone's ultimate objective, and might, henceforth, was the sole decider of right. Next week, we will meet Tiberius's younger brother, Gaius, who sought to outshine his brother not just in the breadth and depth of his reform, but in the unflinching way he willed himself to power. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Last week, we discussed the career of Tiberius Gracchus, whose extreme populism helped kickstart the century of civil strife that would be the Republic's undoing. This is not to say that Tiberius was to blame for the downward spiral, but he certainly staked out a position that forced the Senate to stake out a reactionary counterposition, and it was this polarization, not one side or the other necessarily, that eventually led the Roman people to the safe and comforting arms of Caesar Augustus. Hot on the heels of that number one summer blockbuster, Tiberius Gracchus, Man of the People, came its sequel, Gaius, Revenge of the Gracchi. And like all good sequels, they took what made the original work, doubled the special effects budget, and quadrupled the size of the crises. If protagonist Tiberius had to save the city, Gaius would be tasked with saving the whole world. What I mean to say by all that is that Tiberius entered office, focused on the single issue of agrarian reform, and met his downfall running for an illegal second term. His brother would pick up the baton on agrarian reform, but also add a whole slate of other populist reform measures. And where Tiberius failed to win his second term as tribune, Gaius succeeded and met his own downfall seeking an unprecedented third term. The sequel always has to be bigger, better, and go further than the original. It's just good marketing. Gaius was born in 154 BC, the same year his father died. So where Tiberius at least had some contact with their father, Gaius was raised entirely by their mother. He was destined to live his life in the footsteps of his brother, who was 14 years his elder. The entire career of Gaius Gracchus was defined by the path his brother had cut through the wilderness. It was a combination of family obligation and personal revenge that drove Gaius to press his ambitious reform platform, and for the most part, the younger Gracchi did not have much choice. The supporters of Tiberius and the legions of clients that had built up around the family expected him to carry on the legacy, and Gaius simply could not turn away from those expectations. Gaius even began his career in similar fashion to his brother, attached to the staff of their much older brother-in-law, Scipio Aemilianus. Like Tiberius, he served in Numantia, though was not there at the time of the campaign that so changed Tiberius' life. And where Tiberius was driven to his extreme populism because of a very public rebuking by the Senate, Gaius was driven by the very public murder of his brother by those same senators. His brother's death left Gaius, at 21, the patriarch of the wealthy and influential Gracchi family. For a few years, Gaius did attempt to pull back from a public career, declining to run for office when he came of age. Though, like I say, he couldn't avoid the pressure to follow in the footsteps of his brother, father, grandfather, and ancestors in every direction. Gaius was marked for a public career, and there was nothing he could do about it. In 126 BC, he was elected quaestor, and was assigned by lot to a post in Sardinia, and by all accounts served as an able administrator. But it was on the island that Gaius found himself becoming personally embittered towards the Senate in his own right, not just for real and perceived slights against his family, but slights directed at him personally. As quaestor, Gaius served under the consul Lucius Orestes, and in Roman tradition, if a consul was kept on in a certain territory, becoming a proconsul, then his officers stayed with him. In Rome, political class tensions continued to simmer after the death of Tiberius, and the Senate was keen to keep Tiberius' younger brother out of the city while they undid all his work. So they voted to keep Orestes stationed in Sardinia, and Gaius was forced to stay on. Another year passed, and the Senate voted to keep Orestes on again. Gaius began to feel like the Senate was doing this on purpose. So when the Senate again voted Orestes proconsul for Sardinia, Gaius denounced he was leaving the island. There was nothing illegal about leaving, but it was completely unheard of. And so a Gracchi managed again to turn a binding cultural norm into so much hot air. He returned to Rome and in 123 BC was elected tribune of the plebs like his father and brother before him. The sources differ as to whether Gaius entered office with a revolutionary slate of proposals in hand, or whether his platform grew organically as a response to circumstance. What is not disputed is that by the time he left office, almost every aspect of Roman society had been touched by one or another of his proposed reforms. He began innocuously enough, addressing an issue that is actually in the headlines today, skyrocketing grain prices. Though the slave revolt in Sicily had been put down, a plague of locusts, yes, a plague of locusts, had swept through North Africa, and there was a general shortage of grain coming into Rome. The city, swollen with poor and landless families, faced outrageous markups on basic food staples. The conditions that caused the shortages were real enough, but merchants were having a field day, taking full advantage of the panic in the streets. Gaius simply pushed through a cap on the price of grain. Essentially, the Roman state began to bring in grain and sell it at far below the inflated market rate. This transferred the burden of the price spike off the backs of the poor city dwellers and onto the collective back of the state treasury. The Senate was by no means pleased at Gaius's ingenious plan to invert basic economic common sense, buying high while selling low, but it did solve a pressing social concern, and the people loved it, so there was only so much the elites felt they could do. In Gaius's grain plan, we find the seeds of the later full-on food welfare program that became so important during the Imperium. But for now at least, the Roman state merely provided food at a normal price and was not yet handing it out for free. With the people now fully behind him, Gaius turned to settling old family scores. He passed a measure making it a crime to re-stand for the tribunate if the assembly voted to remove an officer from power. Gaius wanted to be clear that standing in the way of popular will was the shortest route to complete irrelevance, while at the same time he wanted to legitimize Tiberius's recall vote of Octavius 10 years before, which had a very shaky legal foundation at the time. Gaius also passed a measure making it a crime to hand down capital punishment without the approval of the assembly. This measure was aimed directly at an ex-consul named Laenas, who had overseen the trials and executions of many of Tiberius's associates in 132 BC after the elder Gracchi was killed. Gaius's new law contained the provision that it applied retroactively, and Laenas was forced into exile for an act that was only later determined to be a crime. In most countries today, these kind of ex post facto, or literally after the fact, laws are explicitly prohibited as being an obvious source of mischief. Old scores settled, Gaius returned to what had made his brother so popular to begin with, agrarian reform. The Agrarian Commission, which had been rendered impotent in 129 BC, was rebooted and the process of identifying illegally held land and redistributing it was taken up again in earnest. Gaius followed this with laws on military service. Henceforth, no one under 17 was to be drafted, and limits were put on the total number of years of service required. Also, an important step in the evolution of the army, Gracchus demanded that the state provide soldiers with adequate clothing. During his time in Sardinia, he had witnessed firsthand drafted legionaries freezing and miserable from a lack of proper supplies. It was a necessary provision to deal with real suffering, but it was another step on the road to the full-blown state-funded armies that would tear the country apart in the years to come. Rounding out his first year in office, Gaius worked to reform the law courts, opening up the jury pool beyond the senatorial class, which had long held the strings of justice, and creating a commission to investigate charges of bribery, a rampant problem that had been ignored for years. It had been a remarkable year, and Gaius's popularity was at an all-time high. Because of this popularity, Gaius was able to, through no fault of his own, to succeed where his brother had failed and win another term in office. He had not even actively campaigned, but the assembly had failed to grant a majority to 10 tribunes, so the final slots were appointed by those tribunes who had won a majority, and they named Gaius, who, though he had not sought the office, eagerly accepted their appointment. In his second term, Gaius brought to the table one of the thorniest issues of the day and dropped it right in the middle of an already chaotic political environment. The question was on the rights of non-Roman Italians, and specifically, whether they should be made full citizens. One of Gaius's fellow tribunes was a former consul named Marcus Fulvius, who had championed Italian citizenship in 125 BC. It was, in fact, Fulvius's proposal that had inspired the Senate to keep Gracchus in Sardinia. Italian citizenship was an idea whose time had come, but the Senate still balked at the idea of extending full rights to non-Romans. One of their greatest fears was that if they allowed populist reformers like Gracchus and Fulvius to bring the vote to the Italian allies, they would be rewarded with thousands and thousands of new clients ready to vote any way the tribunes directed them. It was an irrational fear, as many of the Italians were feeling the brunt of the Agrarian Commission's redistribution efforts and had no great love for Gracchus. But the conservatives in the Senate began to see boogeymen around every corner. Gaius worked on other issues in addition to the citizenship proposal, shoring up the treasury by increasing the efficiency of provisional tax collection and attempting to release some of the population pressures on Rome by establishing colonies overseas. In total, Gaius's year and a half or so in office had seen him touch almost every aspect of the social order, and universally acting in opposition to whatever the conservatives in the Senate wanted. Near the end of his second term, Gaius sailed for Carthage, where one of his proposed colonies was being built. While he was gone, his voice and charisma left with him, and his enemies began to openly plot the downfall of the troublesome tribune. When Gaius returned, he found his allies had one by one been turned against him, and that all his reforms were threatened by outright repeal. The only option Gaius felt he had available to him was to tempt fate and do the only thing more unthinkable than serving as tribune for two terms, serving for three terms. This time, though, his support amongst the non-senatorial elites was at an all-time low, as a mixture of bribes and threats had done their work. Gracchus was forced to fully embrace the persona of man of the people and hope that he would be able to drum up enough votes to win. He moved from his estate on the Palatine Hill down into a local slum and began, with the help of his Greek speechwriters, to launch into full-throated populist campaign mode. He even went so far as to tear down a set of risers the wealthy would view an upcoming gladiatorial match from because they blocked the view of the commoners. But despite his desperate campaign, Gracchus was defeated in the polls. There were, of course, accusations of fraud, and we will never know whether Gracchus actually won or not, but officially he was out, and the new tribunes, to a man enemies of Gracchus, set about dismantling all his reforms. Gracchus and his colleague Fulvius made the fateful decision to muster a series of public demonstrations against repeal that took on an increasingly violent and seditious overtone. At one of these gatherings, a herald of Gracchus's chief opponent was killed by overzealous Gracchi supporters. As soon as the body hit the ground, Gaius knew he was undone. The tribunate did not waste time leaping from a murder charge against the men actually responsible for the crime to a full-blown charge of treason against Gaius and Fulvius. The two were immediately named enemies of the state and were forced to run. Fulvius was caught and murdered along with his two sons, while Gaius fled with one of his slaves. Cornered, and knowing that capture meant only disgrace followed by execution, he decided to skip the former and ordered his loyal slave to perform the latter. A murder-suicide later, they were both dead, and just like that, the Gracchi, who had so dominated Roman politics for the last decade, were gone. Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus left an indelible mark on Rome and changed the character of its society forever. Whatever the hopes of their political opponents, the Gracchian reforms could not simply be undone. It would take too much violence to remove citizens from their newly created farms, and besides, the negative press would be far too much to overcome. Of all his proposals, the only one to truly die was the matter of Italian citizenship. That would be tabled for another 30 years and require a full-blown revolt before the Italian allies were treated as equals within the state. I believe I mentioned after the end of the Samnite Wars that the Samnites would return with a vengeance in a few hundred years. Well, that time is fast approaching, as they would be leaders in the violence that led to citizenship. The Senate could have saved itself a lot of blood and treasure by simply recognizing the inevitability of extending citizenship, but sometimes things have to get out of hand before the hand finally loosens its grip. Beyond their legal reforms, the Gracchi introduced the idea of mob violence and mob pressure to Roman politics. Until now, the elites had been careful not to empower the masses or hint to them in any way that they far outnumbered their leaders and could, if they wanted to, get their way by sheer physical intimidation. Sure, the early history of the Republic saw a few secession of the plebs, but that was passive civil disobedience, not rioting in the streets. And the lesson of mob violence was a lesson well learned by the next generations, and the streets of Rome will soon run red with the blood of mobs and counter-mobs crashing into one another, egged on by leaders who crave power at any cost. Next week, we will introduce one of those leaders who learned the lessons of the Gracchi all too well. It will take at least two and possibly three episodes to cover the entire career of Gaius Marius. But his career is one of the most important in the late Republic, and it bears going into in some detail. Because the mark he would leave on the Republic would soon come to resemble the kiss of death, as Julius Caesar would follow his father-in-law's career to its logical conclusion and have himself declared dictator for life.